Welcome to The Learning Curve, your industry podcast on all things on enterprise learning. In this episode of The Learning Curve with me, Kenny, I'll be diving into the virtual and augmented reality world and seeing how it applies to learning and development. As always, I'll have a guest who is also an expert, and in this case, it's Peter Klaus, who is the founder of MaxArt, one of Australia's leading VR/AR training technology companies. So, have I piqued your interest? Well, maybe not quite enough. Maybe I can help you a little bit. There's going to be three really interesting topics. Let me just say NASA, space, and diving suits. Is that enough? Hopefully so. If not, well, you're just going to have to listen to the episode to find out more. So, hello, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of The Learning Curve with Kenny. And today we have a very, 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 very exciting and interesting topic for you. The topic is going to be VR and artificial reality training and kind of like space technology kind of stuff and how this applies to the business and corporate world. And with me today is Peter Klaus. Hello, Peter. How are you?
Hi, Kevin. I'm good. Thanks for asking. It's a little bit getting on a little bit here in Australia in terms of time. It's a little bit later here, but it's good to be with you.
Thanks for being available. As Peter just mentioned, he's from Australia, if you didn't notice by his accent yet, which is, of course, charming. Klaus, okay, the Klaus part was actually we had just a pre our recording session. I have to explain this. Sorry, it's an inside joke. I was asked Peter how to pronounce his last name, which is actually spelled C-L-A-W-E-S, right? C-L-A-W-E-S. Okay. Yeah. And I was just asking him on the pronunciation, and he said Klaus, which here in Germany is a reference to a German first name. So that's why. And then I took a little tangent on a story going into John Wick. You'll have to look at the new John Wick to figure that one out. Okay. But anyways, Peter, back to you. And since you're the main part and the guest of this whole discussion. You founded a very interesting company, or you're a co-founder of it, I believe, MaxArt, and the other one is Raytracer, correct?
That's correct.
I'm not sure how you got Raytracer as a company name. How the heck did that work? Because Raytracing is a very, I mean, didn't you have problems getting that even registered?
No, we didn't. That's it's an interesting kind of story. I don't know if you have time for it today, but I can talk a little bit more about it.
Okay, well, give us a short version of what you do for both companies. Like I said, I already alluded to the fact that you basically you're deep into the topic of virtual reality and augmented reality and applying that to various working scenarios. So, give us a little info on that, on the background. Or maybe start off with the story how you got Raytracer, because that's, like I said, I looked it up and I'm a kind of noob. So ray tracing is a familiar thing. And I looked, and I'm like, how the heck did he get that registered? I mean, I just figured that would be gone.
Yeah. I'll start back from the beginning. So, I think MaxArt probably in its eighth year now. I probably have to like look on LinkedIn to how many years has.
We'll look on your LinkedIn profile, right? Then there should be should pop up when you're next, you know.
I think this is year eight, and so we started off just myself. I have a software development background. I saw a demonstration that Microsoft ran time for their new HoloLens that was on stage, and I was kind of familiar with what Oculus was doing with their development kits. I was just like, I was in a job at the time and I just finished up and left and I moved back home and I had this window of like free to do stuff. So I started building applications. I built some AR and some VR apps on dev kits and some people noticed what I was doing and I got to work with some family businesses on a few projects and then that grew into bigger things and started hiring people, and we started building, you know, simulations for lots of big tier one companies, lots of global names.
Mm-hmm.
Like probably for your German listeners, like Volkswagen was a really, really early customer of ours.
Wow.
And a partner really for a huge number of years, and they were absolutely fantastic.
Did you say Hager?
Sorry?
What was the second one?
Oh, no, I said, so Volkswagen was our big one, but a big partner. Like they were for us. More than a client or a customer. Like we go into really deep collaborations with them, which was fantastic, and I really enjoyed it. And we did that for a long time and still continue to do that today. And we've got probably one of the most skilled and larger teams in Australia doing this kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
But about 4 years ago, we started Ray Tracer, just specifically to focus in on space and defense related applications. And there's lots of reasons why. But the name was actually the hardest thing, which sounds so silly because we workshopped it between the co-founders for ages, and we were like, and we get really deep on that stuff because we like to talk about brand more important than anything else, really focusing in on that brand. And at the time, our first product was Titan Lake. So it was an underwater technology. We were doing simulation and using ray tracing. We had some logos which were Stingray-like looking. We were like, I think this sounds, this is going to be a good name for this business, throwing in all of those elements. And we like ummed and ahed, and there were lists and back and forths. And I think we had an application in with a very, you know, prominent venture capital firm. We just didn't pick an ad yet. So I think we were at Japanese one night, and it was just like, this is it, guys. This is the one. Scrap everything else. We're just picking this, and we're gonna go. And Kenneth, not many people pick it up. Not many people have any idea what we're talking about. I'm glad you know.
Well, you know, I was just thinking, how did you ever get? I mean, you said how long ago was your company founded?
Oh, it'd be four and a bit. That Ray Tracer would be 4 years now, maybe four or five years.
I mean, it's a very common term, so I was surprised that you were able to, you know, trademark that. I mean, I was like, okay, how? I don't know how you did that. You know, everybody missed that boat. So,
one of the criteria too was also this, and this sounds weird, but it's like you need to be able to picture this company in space. Like, it needs to be like, imagine a company in 100 years that's doing logistics in space. What's their name? What are they called? Or if they make gravity boots, what's the name of the company? Like, that's the kind of name where, like, it really stands out. We wanted something a little futuristic, a little space sounding, I suppose, for lack of a better
word. Well, you hit that one. I think that one's perfectly great. Okay. So
David,
now we got, you already mentioned the part that we're going to dive into. And that is basically your project that you called Titan Lake. Which is basically a underwater VR simulation for training astronauts in neutral buoyancy conditions. Wow, what a word, what a topic. Okay, so how did you come up with that? I mean, did you just wake up one morning and say, let's just put these guys underwater and figure out, you know, hook up a HoloLens or whatever VR you have and give it to the diver? Or, I mean, how did that come about?
I think the best part about it is it wasn't forced. So we, like, anything we have to force is probably not a good idea. We've learned that over the years. Whereas this thing just came about organically. So we were building, again, one of very few companies that was building not only software, but a lot of custom hardware. Excuse me if you hear my dog barking in the background there.
That's okay. My dog's at home, so no barking here.
I think he wants to come into this room.
Probably does.
We were already building custom hardware peripherals for all sorts of projects and the software to go with them. Whereas I think a lot of our peers were really focused on just software. We were building like custom simulators to go with custom software. So we're already pretty good at building hardware. We had looked at some space and defense related applications, and then what we could do to push the envelope. One of the co-founders of the business, he'd done a little diving, and it sort of explained it was to be, you know, some good applications potentially to do some underwater stuff. Mm-hmm. And so we started just experimenting, and we built some prototypes out, how to play with those, and we realized that there was significant opportunity to contribute to space programs who are quite limited, really, in the types of training that they can do.
Okay, so a very niche market, I would say, to a certain degree.
Very, very.
But as we all know, a lot of good things come from space. Yeah. So we'll segue over to, I don't know, do you know the orange drink called Tang?
Tang, I know
T-A-N-G. Oh yeah, that was supposedly one of the great inventions that came from space, because they didn't have any orange juice, or didn't want to, you know, they tried to dry everything, so they made this orange drink substance that you could mix up in space. So that was one of the things that came supposedly from space exploration. Yeah. But okay, so again, got off a topic there a little bit, but okay. So, but how does that? Could you explain, because I tried to phantom how that actually physically works. And I tried to look up on YouTube something, but there's scarcely any videos on how that's actually done. What do I have to imagine when you're talking about this natural buoyancy or training for astronauts under natural buoyancy? My imagination basically... I've seen a couple cutscenes where they have like I think for the space station, they have a complete mock-up of the space station underwater. And then they put people in literally put them in the astronaut suit, and then they send them into this pool and they work on the space station. So I figured what you guys are doing is you're taking a little bit of shortcut and putting like virtual reality in there so that you don't have to mock up the whole space station in a physical mock-up. Is that, am I heading in the right direction, or...
Yeah, you're absolutely headed in the right direction. So yeah, the facility you're talking about, and there are a few around the world, but probably the most most well known and one with the most footage is NASA's Neutral Buoyancy Lab, mm-hmm. and that is a fantastic training facility. And in my eyes, probably the gold standard in terms of training globally, in terms of the type of training that you could do, mm-hmm. and how it's delivered. But it's also very expensive, very challenging. You know, again, very niche type of training, and it was also designed and developed to support one thing very, 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 very well. Whereas mm-hmm. what happening in the current, I suppose, for lack of a better word, space race and commercialization of space is we're not going to have just the International Space Station. There's four or five other space stations that are being built that will be going up soon. Mm-hmm. We have NASA's Artemis program for loop for the moon, and then you know eventually to Mars, and so. Our hypothesis is that facility may not be able to cope with that level of demand that's mm-hmm. going to be required for that type of training. So you're 100% right. We're like, well, instead of putting whole pieces of a space station in here, let's make smaller pools. Let's make tiny pieces, and then mm-hmm. let's virtualize everything else. You're not necessarily working or using. To give you that, still that presence or what it feels like to be in space.
Okay. How do you then? Okay. So judging from the clips that I saw, I was able to, you know, kind of like infer how the visualization works and how, you know, maybe you can see like any gamer that has a real sense, you can see hands and so forth, and you can manipulate things. But how do you work? What about the movement? How do you simulate that in the tank? I mean, do they have actual jet thrusters that they thrust with, or does somebody drag them along the pool, or how does that part work? I mean,
yeah, it is an interesting one. You can do both. Mm-hmm. How it currently works in the NBL is a bunch of people, I don't know if you've seen the photos, can be like four or five people that drag someone around. They're dragging in this big suit around.
Okay.
At this stage, we're looking at lighter weight suits mm-hmm. That may not require you to be dragged around. Mm-hmm. There are challenges in movement that we're still trying to solve, but ultimately solvable. We mm-hmm. haven't settled on how we will do it. Mm-hmm. I'm able to say we don't want a system that requires four or five people to drag a person around. That's all I can say.
Well, it sounds like the other thing about your solution, now that when I think of it, it's extremely scalable. So, and I think, you know, setting up a situation, like you said, like NASA is the gold standard. So when we think of gold standard, it probably costs kind of like gold money. So in your case, I would assume that you can save a lot of costs would be one of the things, because simply said, you don't need to install a whole, you know, physical copy of whatever you're doing. You can do that in a virtual environment. So that's highly interesting.
Yes.
And so it sounds fantastic. But we'll get to, the interesting thing will be then how this then basically refers to then the business context for learning and development. So we'll see how we can apply it there. The other thing that you also have, and this is, I think, we'll be moving closer with this, is you also have a digital twin, which has real-time remote access to assets, you know, in various locations. So what is, so you have on one side, you have the neutral buoyancy topic, which I would say is very specific, case-specific. And the second topic, digital twin, sounds like it has more of a broader approach or a group of people that it can apply to. Can you tell us a little about digital twin then?
Sure. I think the link for us here is whether it's remote operations here terrestrially, and we're focused on space, right? But if it's here terrestrially on Earth or whether it's in space, we are having to learn to get better at managing those assets.
Mm-hmm.
We are particularly focused around, even though we've been doing digital twin related work for a number of years, we are very hyper focused on its use cases in space,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, it doesn't get any more remote than that. And the challenges are, we're moving from a government organization model where it was okay to have, you know, a few hundred people dedicated to one asset, whereas mm-hmm. now we might have a few hundred people dedicated to hundreds of assets, right? So they have to be managing all of these things all the time. And so you do need a better operating picture of what that looks like, mm-hmm. even to the point where, like, our vision is that you can stand next to your assets on the lunar surface in a simulated environment, or but they're on Mars, you can stand next to them and your team can stand around them and plan around them and, you know, plan the next day's maneuvers or tasks that you're going to do. That's kind of a vision for it.
Let me make a quick distinction. In the natural buoyancy, in Titan Lake, basically you're learning how to operate a certain unit. But now in the other digital twin, are you actually, when you say access to assets, are you manipulating these assets, or is it just what I'm envisioning here, or the question that I have, is it kind of like a drone thing where you're basically operating some type of remote arms somewhere on Mars, or something? Or is it still the setting that you are like you said, your team is looking at, you know, a construction on site, so to say, in a virtual aspect? Yeah. Or is it actual, you're doing something, extending your reach to actively do something in the other location?
Yeah, it's both. It's both. That ability to visualize your asset, and I would have picked the ones that we're really focused around. So a roving platform on the lunar surface, the ability to stand, it feels like in situ with it. Mm-hmm. It's got its environment, and then to go, okay, well now I need to control you to go and do it, and then working with a group of people to control that movement and allow it to simulate and then act. So that's kind of our focus.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Blows my mind. All right. Yeah. So that actually brings. Yeah.
I was going to say, ultimately, like, we see people and machines just working closer together, right? Whether that's here terrestrially or in space, like that's kind of our vision.
Okay. Well, okay. So, so that's a perfect segue to now the question of applying it to a business or corporate world. So, like we said, you know, a lot of space technologies, you know, because they're so far out there, take a while to adopt and then trickle down to applications, you know, in our real world scenario or for the broader individual. So astronauts undergo an extensive training before embarking on these space missions. What aspects of their training can be adapted and applied to training and learning programs in other industries?
I'm going to start with the most obvious one.
Okay, could I have answered this question myself? Or
listeners, like, because it's my I suppose subject area. Like, NASA's been using virtual reality for decades, right? So they're well versed in using this technology, and I think they've used it to great effect to do some of the most challenging things we've ever done, as humans have ever done. Mm-hmm. They've achieved a lot of that by using simulation technology, and
really?
I think. I think we're seeing organizations transition as we see virtual reality, in particular, technology democratized. Mm-hmm. So you know, when NASA's dealing with simulation systems in years gone past, we're talking at great expense. Whereas now, anyone can go down to the shop and buy a VR headset, but that wasn't mm-hmm. possible, you know, even a decade ago. I think that is the lowest hanging fruit. I think some other things that they do well, they do a lot of like cross-disciplinary training stuff. So they'll have mm-hmm. teams going out and doing different things, which mm-hmm. may look a little abstract at the time, but they're actually learning really key skills, leadership, management.
Interesting.
And they get, you know, you might be a geologist or something like that, but then they'll get you involved in some training across something that's not even in your area of expertise or your field. And having been very fortunate to spend some time with astronauts over the last couple of years, is they're very good at selecting well-rounded individuals, first of all, but mm-hmm. specialists become really, really well-rounded and cross-disciplined in lots of areas. And I love to see organizations with cross-disciplinary training.
Okay, so I mean that's a big takeaway, and it makes when you low hanging fruit. Yeah, okay, I could have thought of that. Now that you've
said it, offense to you, too.
No. But now that you've said it, it's something that I can absolutely get behind, and I can envision that because I can see how that type of cross training can get you to, especially for people that are specialized in something, to think out of the box, because you've been introduced to other ways of thinking, other ways of going about a task. And especially, for a specialized individual, that will get you to work a little bit different and think about things different. So, okay, then we'll pick up on the topic of remote training. Remote training can sometimes lack the hands-on experience that traditional in-person training provides. So what lessons can be learned for space technology to incorporate hands-on components in a remote training program? Oh, that's a good one. That one, I really have to think about that one. Or maybe it's obvious again.
This one's not so obvious. And I think one thing that we've learned over the years is we tend to look at the space industry, and in many cases it is kind of this pinnacle, but we tend to like maybe make it really think that it's really, really glamorous kind of thing, when in fact they have similar struggles to the corporate world as well. Mm-hmm. I think this one is one where it is particularly challenging. I'll give you an example. Like the astronaut training cohorts are generally done together. They're very rarely done with people in remote locations and having to collaborate. Now we want to change that with Titan Lake a little bit, being able mm-hmm. to have things and virtually do it. But I think even to that extent, there is some struggle. I was very, very fortunate though to just by absolute chance land into a project during the pandemic where teams were remote mm-hmm. on a space project. And what they did was, and I can't go into any specifics.
Your dog's getting closer now.
He is getting closer. He's no longer on Golden Retriever, Kenneth. And he died, and he just wants his night cuddles from Ravens, not get to the
same. Did he figure out how to open the door or what?
Actually, I have to leave it slightly open because I think he'll panic if I close it on it. Oh, what are you doing in there?
Oh, okay.
So sorry. I was very fortunate. I won't talk too much about the project itself, but you got to see it inside of a remote team kind of operate, and there were lots of things that were really important. Communication tools were really, really critical, and having good communication tools across the team and something standardized. And that's not just like like video conferencing. I'm talking about very project specific tools that they built to relay the information correctly. We worked with them on some experimentation for using virtual reality technologies to bring team members closer together so that they could, collaborate a little bit more realistically and have that kind of, try and create a more personal connection. This was some old technology a few years ago. But it is, I still think, a challenge for all industries is like, how do we bring these remote teams together? I personally think VR is going to be a great tool for that, but we're not quite there yet.
Okay. So yeah, we have that, we can see that. I think that is a big discussion that's going on in the corporate world right now moment, because, with the pandemic, everybody moved into, remote office and home office and blah, blah, blah. And everybody was amazed. Wow, it's really working. Something that, probably a whole bunch of developers are like going, duh. Yeah, of course. I've been sitting in my office for 10 years now. Where's the problem? Or my home office. We're also seeing the pendulum is swinging back people want that personal, hands-on, traditional interaction back, either partly from the individuals, I would say, but also very much from the companies. Now, I don't know if it's driven by the fact that companies think that exchange is still necessary, or that exchange is integral, or they're just upset that they now have tons of open office space that you're paying for and nobody's showing up to. So I don't know what that driver is. Care to put in a wager on that?
Yeah,
2 cents on that.
I am an optimist, and so I like to think whatever's comfortable for you, and as long as the business is continuing to deliver results for its customers, clients, partners, et cetera, then I'm sort of comfortable wherever anyone wants to work. And I do think, and I hope that wins, regardless of that means more at home, less at work. I hope it, but I have seen the benefits in our organization of having that flexible approach. And I hope it continues. And with that in mind, I do think better tools are coming that's going to improve that collaboration.
Oh, okay. Do you care to let us know, or is that insider?
Well, there are some publicly available ones. So I think, I think Meta, my opinion, I think Meta unfairly has copped a lot of flack over the last couple of years about their metaverse kind of approach and bringing collaboratively. And I don't know. I think, I think maybe some of that was a little misinterpreted by the market, et cetera, but the actual practical things that they are doing and the steps they're taking along the journey are fascinating. And if you want to look at one particular technology, as an example, Codec Avatars, if you get time, that's a really fantastic project that they're working on there. And that is going to unlock a lot of remote work if they can get that right.
Okay. Well, since I got you to say something on that topic, since you mentioned Meta, I'll go on a little tangent. Zuckerberg or Musk? Who's going to win? who's going to win the cage fight?
No, I don't.
You don't have to answer that.
And some of my clients, because on one side of me, Mark Zuckerberg has been just what he's done for VR and AR technologies for the last, particularly, let's say, 5 years, is just unmatched. And a lot of the people in our industry wouldn't have jobs if it wasn't for him. So I'm very grateful. Thanks.
So you're Camp Zuckerberg.
Let me put that on. What Elon has done for space, I don't think almost anyone has come close to.
I just put you in between a rock and a hard spot.
You did.
Because you got the greatest guy, pushing VR, and you got the other guy so you're pretty much on the fence on this one.
I am on the fence on this one. I have huge respect for what Elon has done, in particular at SpaceX. And I think that if we I'd be surprised if we get to Mars and he doesn't play a huge role in the fact that we do that.
Okay.
And that enough alone to me, you're like, yeah, you can't not respect that.
Yes, definitely. I would that if that does come to be, that would be monumental. So to say the least. One of the other, we briefly touched on this before I went completely off script or off target here. In the process of working remotely, the other thing that you have is basically you have we know that astronauts, of course, undergo a lot of physical and mental fitness training. And one of the topics that, since the epidemic has also been the question of mental health and how this isolation, remote training, so forth has, kind of isolated people and affected their mental health, some positive, some negative. How do you see remote training programs integrating, similar support mechanisms for well-being or, the resilience of learners?
Yeah, without knowing absolutely every program NASA does, I know enough, and I think the general public do know enough to know that they really lead in this kind of area. So ensuring that their astronaut candidates are mentally tough and mentally fit. And they run a lot of great programs and technologies in order to be able to do this. I do think the corporate world can learn a little bit from this, but from the broad side, so like NASA invest a lot in their people. And I think the corporate side, and I'm sure you're probably across this, Kenneth, in your role, but like, I've seen the percentage budgets that the tier ones assign to learning and development programs, for example. And I personally find it shocking that the hence in the word company, right? It's a group of people, and there's so little investment in the people. There's so much investment in things like marketing and advertising and, investment in the business, brand. But proportionally, I think little investment in the people.
And really?
I think so. I look at percentage budgets the companies spend on just their people, just like upskilling their people, keeping their people. And they do spend a lot of money. I'm not saying they don't, but I think you will see upticks in advertising, marketing, brand, da 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 da. I started with the core part of that, which is the people. I think that's one of the big lessons we can take away from, from space-based programs in general, is they put a lot of, they build the world's biggest pool. They put pieces of the space station inside it to train 5 or 6 people a year. Yeah. Now, that's an investment in people.
Well, yeah, but you do have a point, but I mean, you're talking about also, an elite program. So, I mean, you're at the top of the top of the top. So, you're talking about individuals that are already, when they come to you, without a question, are elite in their field. And of course, if I was a business, I would invest, tons in this, because not only are these people elite, but the product and the scope of failure is also magnified by a lot. Now, how do you scale that down to a small business or smaller businesses, let's just say? I would tend to agree that sometimes the investment in the individuals is less than it could ideally be. But then we get into a whole big discussion, because then you have various points, because if you invest a lot in the employees, then of course you would hope that there's a certain amount of, the other thing we're faced with nowadays is in this remote learning environment is that people switch jobs a lot. So deter companies a little bit, because you spend all this time getting somebody up to a certain level, and then they basically take that knowledge, cash in, and go somewhere else. So there is that risk for companies too. So
it is definitely it's a balancing act, right? It's definitely a balancing act. I think two and other things that we've just sort of noticed along the way, really strong leadership programs, even with like remote teams, and on making sure that you're as many team members as possible have access to leadership programs. And often we've seen in the difference between the two, having worked across both, is that we only see leadership development programs for that elite executive level when actually maybe leadership needs to be something that's rolled out organization-wide. Like everybody needs to be a leader.
Interesting. Okay.
So it's things like that, which kind of I would like to see.
Okay. Okay. So the other thing that I like to take a look at is communication and collaboration. I mean, we've touched on it a little bit, but is there a need for precise? You might have mentioned it already. Precise and effective communication between teams on Earth and astronauts in space. How does that work? What can remote working teams in general learn from space teams for their communication? I think you alluded to it earlier when you had said one of the things that you had set up. You had a very good in the pandemic time. You had the you had that situation where you're able to see how that develops. But could you be a little bit more specific on that, or could you give you a couple pointers?
Sure. Lots of points on this one. So I think like a really common and understood language that everyone could communicate across, and that can be just making sure that people understand product, services, business lines, those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is number one, so that when people are communicating across worlds, and especially remote teams, that language is precise.
Mm-hmm.
I also think the timing of that is important too, maybe overlooked a little bit.
Timing?
So like, I'm not really timing it. I mean, like often, and there's a lot of stuff coming out recently about how much time we're spending in meetings and how long those meetings are. Da, 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 da. Like, I think you want to shorten that. Real common language, nice and short, real precise.
Okay.
When you still want to deliver that with tact, but I think like ultimately well articulated and concise is key.
Mm-hmm.
I think using effective communication channels for certain things. So like, I think we know video conferencing is great for some things, really good.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you are holding something practical, you're running a demonstration, you have a physical thing. So for that, you need a communications channel, which is in person. So make sure you've got meeting rooms. You may have some communication methods where everyone needs to be outside the office because it's a team building or a leadership thing. So just making sure that you've got all of those channels set up, and not just one channel that everybody has to flow through. So if you've only got video call, then that might be a problem, especially if that's your only communication method. So they'd probably be my top three: clear language, keep it concise, and then just making sure that you've got a good number of channels that people could communicate on, because everybody's different.
Huh. Okay. Interesting. That makes sense to me. But once again, it's it's scary, because sometimes when you say it like that, it sometimes comes down to common sense. The irony of it,
And it does.
It just takes somebody to mention it, and especially when you said common language and concise meetings, and I would say that is I've noticed also in my personal surroundings is that I would say that oftentimes meetings aren't concise enough. Through people not being in face-to-face communication, where a lot of nuances are communicated that you can't pick up virtually, people make up for it by being, in virtual meetings and then just going off and asking everything they can, because
that's right. That's right.
And that then tends to, lead to, those classic, seriously expanded meetings that you're like going, oh God, and then, one department's talking about about something that has no interest for the other department. So they tune out and things like that. So, I will definitely take that with me, to make meetings more precise and a common language and to the point.
Yeah, and you say like it is common sense. It's a really, really like important reminder. Like I mentioned before, like often one of the things I've kind of learned in the last few years, especially getting to learn more about the space industry is that you think it's going to be this really highly convoluted, complicated thing, but actually what you really need is to do the simple things and do them really, really, really well. And so they often focus on simplicity. Actually, it's really simple stuff, and we just get it right, we get it right, we get it right. And that's how we make sure the rocket always launches and people always survive and all of those sorts of things. It's not the really complex, complicated things. It's still it's already complicated enough, right? You don't need to make it any-
And here we go. Okay, then you basically you went right into the next question that I was going to ask, and that's basically you already said it a little bit. Designing, how do you approach the designing of a user experience in virtual or augmented reality? How do you ensure the balance between immersion and usability? That'd be the next thing that I'd like to know.
Sure.
Because you kind of already alluded to it. I mean, we went from making the meetings, precise, but now we're going back to, virtual reality and how I think that's, it does interest me. How do you, between immersion, because little X course again, I had another colleague on a podcast, and we also talked about virtual reality, and I also had I think I had the HoloLens on, and he introduced me into a virtual meeting room, which was kind of like an auditorium. And at that point, we had avatars, and we decided to do the podcast using this virtual classroom and this virtual auditorium, in which I had little avatars, and they didn't look very realistic. So they were like very comic book character. Which was pretty interesting. But then all of a sudden my usability went down the tubes because I had this headset on, and at the same time, I also have a range of questions that I want to ask. So I have a little couple notes that I've taken down, and I noticed I didn't have access to my notes because I had the headset on. And to compound the fact, not only did I have my headset on, so I had to look out of the headset, underneath the goggles, onto my screen to read my questions that I had. I compounded the fact that for some reason I still had a screensaver on. So the damn thing would turn off every 20 seconds. I have to try to find my keyboard and touch it. And at the conclusion of the whole thing, he then told me, what we could have done, we could have just simply put since it was an auditorium setting and I was at the podium or whatever, we could have put your questions as a PowerPoint display behind you on the screen. I'm like, oh, that would have been nice to know. So I could have read my questions there. So that's where immersion versus usability. So how do you design your user experience there?
I'm going to answer this in two parts. So the first part is not your fault, Kenneth. one of the really tricky parts about VR, and I think it's often overlooked, especially if you're not really in it, living and breathing it, is the end user experience. Mm-hmm. And people think, if you build a thing and you give it to the user, great. Actually, you really need to curate and make sure that user experience is the best thing that it can possibly be. And as people in the industry, we kind of are custodians of that, and we need to make sure because when if you have a really good experience in VR, it's almost like evangelical, right? You have a really good experience.
Yeah.
Have a poor experience, you'll never pick up a headset again. And I think we, as an industry, maybe haven't been the best custodian of making sure that.
Do you fall into that trap of? Oh, it's intuitive.
100%. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And actually, you need to make zero assumption and go, okay, we need to make sure this person, from when they time they put this on to when they take it off, that there's a big smile on their face and ultimately they took something away. Okay. Everything is made. Everything you do should be about that. So that's a starting point. And so I feel sorry for you that you had that experience.
Oh, it was fun because it was new, and it did show. I mean, it's a classic thing of where you said, designing the experience. How does that work, and how do you tailor it to fit? What you're doing, and later, like I said, for my colleague, it was probably, of course, makes sense. It's intuitive, and it makes sense to use it. But for me, then it was like, he hadn't thought of I didn't mention to him that I wanted to read any notes. So of course he didn't, you know, say that I could post it there. So, so that was okay. But it was still an interesting, setup. Although I have to say, it was a little bit, the application was a little bit estranging because I couldn't picture myself actually being in this environment for too long. So, there's probably a limit to how long I would want to be in a virtual environment, and depending, of course, on the quality of it. But still, there's probably a limit to how long I could. I mean, taking a normal exchange that we would have, you know, in a virtual atmosphere, I have to see. That's a different discussion. Okay, so since we're heading to the end of our podcast, there's probably so many questions that I still haven't asked. But we'll do
whatever one.
We'll do a quick. We're getting like I said, we're gonna get. Let me see. There's two things that still come up. Since we were talking about the topic of how to set up engaging and immersive learning experience using VR and AR, what would you say are the top three hacks that a business should look into when trying to apply a technology to their learning environment? Wow, that's pretty expensive, actually.
Top three hacks.
Let me narrow down the question. Now that I stated the question, let me narrow it down. If I have probably for your Volkswagen scenario, that would be probably a good explanation. How did the company go about saying, okay, identifying that I have a need in my learning area that I want to transfer this learning experience from a face-to-face or whatever learning experience into a virtual augmented reality? Where do companies start in identifying that need as such? There you go.
This is a great question. And I like this because I think this is kind of a gold standard of how to approach this. Mm-hmm. So when I first met Volkswagen, they had looked into it and kind of understood maybe some of the pros and cons. So they went and did their own homework and thought, okay, well, here's some areas where I apply it. So I went over, I met with them, I brought all the kit. This is a long time. Was it 7 years ago? 6-7 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Sat down, went through the stuff. They knew straight away. Evangelical. They were just like, yep, we know it's going to do this. But before we do any of that, Pierre, we've got an event. One of our new cars is launching. It's a week-long press event. We're going to fly you down there. We're going to put you up. You're going to go hang out there for a week and just get to know it. Tell us. Go spend some time out there. Tell us what it can do. So I went down. They put me up at a beautiful hotel, and I got to drive cars for a week with their team and really go behind the scenes with their brand for a new launch. And I came back and I handed them a report, and I said, here's where I think the areas that you can work in. I won't tell you what all those are, but here's the things that I think you can progress. And they were like, great. We agree. Probably one of the big key words, and you said it, is experience. They're saying the word experience all the time. Mm-hmm. That's a really key word in saying that in your organization. We want our staff to experience this, that VR can be a really good tool. Not always, but it can be if you dig a little deeper. And then they also got me personally immersed in the brand. So they loaned me a car for a little while. I already drove a Volkswagen, but they loaned me a brand new one learn about the car, learn about the experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just a good practice, is like if you're getting involved with a VR developer or vendor, get them immersed in what you're trying to do. And that really helped. Because we, from early on, understood who they were and what they were about. And that filtered down through everything that we developed over the years. Okay. And built a great relationship as well. But they, I think for organizations too, they went and did their own homework and realized what was and was not possible, which I don't think a lot of organizations do. They usually come cold.
You know what? Here again, we're back to the topic that this is the theme of our conversation, common sense. And I would have to say your explanation actually mirrors a lot of things that I think sometimes the expectation of the customer is simply that they go to somebody, they're the service provider, and they're supposed to have all the answers. They're supposed to come up with everything, not knowing their own needs, not doing their homework, and looking looking at what is possible and what their vision is. They come in and they expect the service provider, in this case you, to basically come up with a solution, not knowing even what they want. And that and the perfect example was that I had that same experience in the case that I had. Let me not tell this story wrong. Let's just say I had a ring made, okay? And when I went to the jeweler, I'm like, I want a ring. And he's like, what kind of ring? I'm like, I don't know. You're supposed to tell me what kind of ring. And he's like, and that's where the whole thing went off. And that's the classic case where I would say the segue is then basically Volkswagen did their homework, researched on where they think they had their needs and had a clear vision. And at that point, they were able to go to you and communicate that vision and immerse you into their universe. And with your expertise, you were then able to tailor their needs and their experiences to what they need. Wow. Okay.
And that approach delivered like several world firsts.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of awards for that company at a national learning programs, mm-hmm. a lot of international recognition, and all because they took some really deliberate, strong steps initially, and didn't just go, hey, we're starting today. They spent months prepping before anyone even picked up a tool.
Wow. Okay. So I think that's a good takeaway. So I'm not sure if the takeaway of our podcast is actually, virtual reality and how does it apply to learning and development, or is it just use common sense, people? I don't know.
I do talks like this, Kenneth, maybe three or four every year. And really, it's the easy part nowadays, thanks to providers like Meta, building the software.
Mm-hmm.
When deploying it on the hardware, that is the easy bit. The hard bit is all the stuff that comes before that in the consultation, design, development, and then the bit that comes after end users using it to actually get something from. They're the really hard bits. The technology part, that's the easy.
Okay, so the quintessence of the whole thing is if we had if our podcast listeners, either individuals or maybe either other learning and development individuals or professionals. So if you want to apply this type of technology, then basically do your homework, research what you think you want to use it for, and come up with a vision. Would that be pretty much concise and to the point?
100%. I would love to talk to more customers where they have a fully formed idea. And almost all of the ones we work with have usually the ones we work with come to us with that.
Mm-hmm.
People don't come to us with that. We sometimes just go in circles and we can't actually find a way to work together because there's no starting point.
Okay. But okay. One defense that I do have in for the customers though is do you have the experience that the customers are are they willing to do scoping? So are they willing to pay, like if you didn't do your homework, then we could say there's a cheat code. And the cheat code would be in my vision is to do a scoping workshop to help us as a customer understand what technology we're facing. Because oftentimes, I have to admit, it's easy for me to say, do your homework, but there's a limit to how much I can self-educate. so for me, I would like to rely on an expert. And maybe that would be in the terms of at least having the expert explain what is the technology that I'm dealing with so that I can better understand it. And at that point, I can formulate my use case. So as in the case of the ringmaker story, basically, he gave me a couple samples. He's like, well, this, this, and this. And then we narrowed it down a little bit. So how do you see an application for that in your work.
100%. 100%. And do you have like the big consultancy firms in Germany? I'm not 100% familiar, but do you have like, you know, the Accentures and PwC?
Yep.
Or Deloitte?
Definitely.
And all. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think they do a lot of that work globally. For better or for worse, I think some of it's good, some of it's not so good. Mm-hmm. But that's normal market stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the challenges I've seen is that when a client of ours, or typically a tier one, they might use a consultancy for that above the line kind of consultancy,
mm-hmm.
and then use us to do the build.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there's a disconnect between what is consulted upon and then what's actually feasible or practical to deliver. I absolutely think there's room for it.
Okay, but that would mean that basically the companies are basically using the consultancy company as in between. Does it make more sense to cut out the middleman and go to Ustream? Or is that out of your range of things that you offer?
Yeah, no, it's not out of what we offer. Sometimes we'll do either, or sometimes, and it's challenging, we'll do both.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to be mindful of that. I think ultimately it's valuable. I think some of the larger organizations are getting better at that process. And certainly mm-hmm. we've worked with a few over the years. So I absolutely think that there's room for that high level strategy and making sure all that stuff's in place before you pick up a tool.
Okay. So, wow. This is, like I said, this has been really exciting, interesting for me. Probably a lot of questions that I didn't ask or still would like to ask. But let's give, for the last part, let's give our listeners a little like key things. So in our whole journey here that we had today, we went through a couple of topics. The main point was, basically how do we apply virtual and augmented reality to a, corporate learning and development environment. And for me, the biggest takeaway would be now that the most of our conversation was leading up to understanding everything. But the biggest takeaway for me now was basically learning what scenario you want to apply the technology to. Doing your own homework and seeing, does this technology fit my needs? Do I have a vision with how I'd like to apply the technology? Because at the very least, if you have a vision, then I can come to somebody like you and say, does this make sense? And you would say yes or hell no or whatever. So what would you add on to that in our conversation, like one of the biggest takeaways for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. I touched on a couple of the global one, which is that word experience. So if you find yourself using that, we want the staff, customer to experience it, then it's worth an investigation. I think virtual reality is very, I would use virtual reality too if you've got anything kinesthetic in nature. So anything that's learning by doing,
mm-hmm.
I take that a step further and say, do you have the appetite for learning by failure? I personally prefer it. I think there's a lot to learn through failure.
Oh boy, we're off on another subject, learning by failure. I'd get into that subject, but we'll be another hour, so okay. I'll leave that one out, okay. So, boy.
Yeah. We'll do a part two one day. But I don't think advocates for that, especially using simulated environments, because it's safe, repeatable, measurable, all mm-hmm. of those things. It's not as if I'm going to put someone out on I'll use a service vehicle or something like that, and they're going to fail on someone's car, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think they're things that we typically look for. We tend to shy away. So there is a group of, like, you can still have experience, but then I'm not a big fan of the stand there statically and observe it thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think to be delivered better in video, face-to-face, e-learn, I don't think you need to do that in virtual reality.
Okay.
Now, from an augmented reality perspective, I think that is very good for bringing contextual information into the real world.
Okay.
But there's still quite a journey that technology has to go on. And I think we're really starting to see the lines blur between the two right now, which is really exciting. Meta's doing some interesting stuff. Apple's doing some really interesting stuff.
Here we go. Another subject. You've broached another subject. I'd ask you 20 questions about that, but I have to refrain myself because running out of time for this podcast. Otherwise, it's going to be like a five-hour podcast. You would have to bring up Apple at the end of the discussion. The burning question would be, With their new technology they're bringing out, you know, I'm curious about that. But okay, we'll stop there before I go off too much. Okay, cool. So, Peter, I think that it's thank you very, very much for being available and giving us a little insight on this and our listeners. And it was a very, very interesting journey into space exploration, basically technology and whatever, you know, whatever. I mean, like I said, I never, before talking to you, I never knew you even existed in that sense or that this was a thing. So for me, this was a learning experience right off the top of that. Another thing that I learned basically off this whole thing is, or the common thread I have to grin when I look about, you know, using and applying common sense, an oft underestimated tool, I believe. So that was really interesting to see how, again, you know, in certain things you break it down to a very basic level. And once you break it down to the basic level, it becomes more accessible, usable, and whatever else you want to say to that. So thank you again for bringing that into my current mindset. And the last and final question I have for you is who or what would you recommend the next podcast? So when I say who, if you have an individual that you can think of without putting anybody on the spot, if you don't want to put anybody on the spot, that's fine. Then you can text me later if you have somebody that you think I should reach out to, or maybe a topic that you think that would be interesting to delve into. For example, I had in one of my podcasts that we talked about and an interesting connection to what you said was he recommended that I talk to the military about their learning, because just like you mentioned in the NASA scenario, you have in NASA it was very specific, but you had a lot of cross training. For the military, you simply have such a big spectrum because you're training everything. You're training, you know, individuals that are going to go into a life and death situation, all the way down to a mundane situation of cooking, let's say, you know, and that spectrum and how does an organization deal with that is immensely interesting. So if you have something like that, that would be great.
I probably have like 100 names of people that are just like rolling through my head and their topics that they would talk about. But I'll go to one that a person I had huge respect for and that I've actually collaborated with on lots of projects over the last couple of years. And that is a friend of our company. Her name is Anita Menon, and she worked at. She's got her own sort of instructional design consultancy, and we've been working with her a lot around gamification projects and simulation projects. And she's been helping us a lot with story and narrative and characters and all of these things. Okay. And I think her work is often people see our stuff as the here's the thing, but actually, she does a lot of work with us in the background, making sure that the design all works and makes sense and can deliver it. She's very good at breaking down to the first principles. What are we trying to do here, simply, quickly, easily?
Okay.
I'd recommend Joan.
Okay. I will definitely take that up. So basically, the nuts and bolts of instructional design. I think we've done a similar topic, but that's, I think, something that might be a little bit overseen by individuals that, you know, they simply don't take into that, you know, what goes into that. I mean, I created content for IMC here, and I know that part of the journey quite well. So that is a very fascinating subject if you haven't, you know, don't have any experience with it or touched upon it.
And it's not just like, I'd say IMC's really high standard. Really, really high standard globally in terms of your designs.
Thank you.
And the project worked out. I'd love to see some and spend some time with your Australian team. So you guys are doing amazing work. And I think, you'd be really fascinated by some of the stuff in the universe because she's really on that, right on the creative edge of that instructional design. So she's not afraid to push boundaries and try new things, which I think is why we like working.
Okay. All right. Well, Peter, maybe next time we'll do it. Since I left a lot of meat on the bone in this conversation, at least a lot of questions that I came up with that I'd still like to ask and delve into, you know, especially learning by failure. That's an a fascinating topic, and I'd like to see how that can be applied in businesses. Although right off the top of my head, I would say, you know, there should be a culture of allowing failure, because it's through failure that you learn the most. You know, if everything works fine, then everything works fine, you know, but it's the failure where you learn the most, because then you really learn how to adapt. Boy, we're already going into the other conversation here, Peter. Again, you just got me wrapped up.
I'm waiting for... Learning by Failure, Vision Pro headsets from Apple, and we'll do John
for the next one. Okay. Peter, thank you very, very much for finding time to come onto the podcast here and to share your experience, your vision, your views, and just your good-natured self. And I think your dog is happily looking forward to the moment that, you know, that you're going to give the attention to him. But he's been silent now, so I think he's calmed down. He's like, good, my boss is in the podcast, so I'm fine with that. Okay, Peter, then thank you, like I said, again, very, very much. Anybody that wants to reach out to you, we'll, you know, provide general contact information if the topic, you know, has found some, you know, purchase there, and then they can, you know, reach out to you through the normal channels. And anybody listening to the podcast, if you like the podcast, then I would appreciate it if you smash the like button, or even better, subscribe. That would be fantastic. And yeah, thanks for listening. Till next time, this was a learning curve with me, Kenny. Thanks a lot.
This podcast is brought to you by MC Learning, and we'll release a new episode every month. I'm your host, Kenneth Littlepage. Editorial planning and script by Simon Breslaw and Vanessa Klaes. Post-production and design, Lars Knuck. If you like the episode, we would be happy if you subscribe to our podcast and recommend it to your friends and colleagues.